We have a lot of questions online, but maybe do you want to start first out?
Thank you. So, yeah, we will take one question online and one from the room. Please state your name and organizational affiliation, and we will pass the microphone. So would you like to start in the room?
Sure.
Yep. Okay.
There's a question over here.
Hi. Can you hear me? Okay. I'm Kathy Salvaggia. I'm in the Africa Bureau at USAID, and I'm a gender advisor. And I have just this afternoon, in fact, this is not my area, so I can't pretend to know a lot about it, but I've been trying to do a gender analysis on a potential project that will make that will try and reach smallholder farmers through in three countries in Africa with two kinds of services. One would be access to a fuller suite of financial services. Maybe I got here late, so but you know, beyond money transfers to, you know, microinsurance and savings and et cetera. And the other is a closer links with buyers, between sellers and buyers. Now, I reviewed a couple of studies online for Tanzania, which is one of the countries, and I really have to ask for poor people in general, but even more so for women in rural areas. I mean, it just seems like there are these enormous barriers to entry, that some of which are quite out of their control, that I didn't hear you addressing at all. I mean, one of these studies said that, you know, 32% of women versus 49% of men, or maybe 50-something percent of men in the rural areas had access to mobile phones. And of course, it was much higher in urban areas. But that a key problem was electricity, that they had to walk 2 hours to actually charge their phones if they had them. And that was lost time from work, you know, and from productive activity. So that was a key problem. And then, of course, I think there's this other issue, which is, even if they have the phones, even if they have electricity, what, you know, how do you get beyond the problem that they don't qualify for these financial services anyway, because they may not, you know, actually be able to qualify for them? That's a huge problem with women's access to credit, for instance, So I just get a little skeptical about mobile phones as the answer to all development problems. There's it's such a bandwagon these days. So I just want your response to that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I mean, we don't want to be Pollyannish about the challenges especially with respect to mobile take-up, right, that you pointed out. I mean, there's certainly areas in Africa where they're just, you know, very difficult to even get a signal, let alone afford a mobile phone and use it. So I guess, you know, on that one, I would say that the rapid diffusion of mobile phones has been pretty dramatic. It's exceeded most people's expectations to this point. And, you know, it's proceeding apace. And, you know, it you're right. There are going to be people who are just always going to be hard to reach, and for whom mobile is not going to be the answer, probably. But I think for the, you know, if you look at the diffusion of mobile phones in Africa, and actually I had a graph that I didn't show, but, you know, just by country, how many people have a mobile phone, and also how many people actually use one but don't own one. And it you know, it's over 80% of the population in some countries, right? And over 75% of the population in maybe three-quarters of the countries in this sample, if you count both types. So people can use a phone without owning one. You know, some people are actually exploring models for how do you do financial services over a phone that's not yours, right? Because that's a challenge, because how do you identify the person who's using it and that sort of thing. So there's some experimentation there, but, yeah, I mean, you don't want to be, yeah. So you don't want to be, I mean, you know, but the challenge is just difficult no matter what you do, right? The people who don't have access to a phone, I mean, it's not like they have some other much better option. It's just tough anyway to reach those people, so... And as far as qualifying for credit in particular, I don't know if you're referring to sort of having the right ID and all that sort of thing to sign up for an account, or.
Well, usually for women, it's a question of not having collateral.
Right.
In order to qualify for any kind, not having access to land to use to get credit. But it may be also, you know, literacy levels and all, you know, just very difficult procedures to get a identification number or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So there are lots of issues, I think, there. And I just, you know, there's this tendency to present these things as silver bullets, and I just think that, you know, the host of issues are just large. When we're talking about really small rural producers, more so than urban ones.
I agree. I mean, the challenge for reaching those people is always going to be huge, and the hope is that eventually phones will start to reach, you know, nearly universal within, at least at the household level, maybe not at the individual level. And as far as the credit thing, I mean, you know, potentially this is not a panacea either, but people have begun experimenting with credit scoring using mobile data.
That's right.
In particular, you know, mobile airtime purchases and that sort of thing. There's a lot of, actually, providers in East Africa who are pretty excited about that, and people trying different models. So potentially, you know, that helps to overcome the lack of collateral, for instance, when you can use your digital. I mean, these are people who maybe have never had any sort of financial history, and now naturally, by being part of a mobile, you know, either just by owning a mobile phone and using it, or being part of a mobile money service, they're now generating a financial record over time. So you can leverage it if you can come up with the right sort of data algorithm. Again, that's not going to solve everyone's problem, but we think that there's huge potential to at least make progress. So,
one other piece.
Just to clarify on that point, can you please... just to understand your point a little bit better, can you please tell us the models that you were referring to? Are they with the mobile operators offering financial services through credit scoring, or the banks offering the financial services through credit scoring through mobile?
Well, you see everybody, people from each camp are excited about it. So we talked to mobile operators, some of them are excited. Banks are excited and launching programs, and then there's third parties, just sort of startups, you know, entrepreneurial startups getting funding from somebody to develop the models and be an intermediary between cell phone companies and banks to sort of sell scoring and that sort of thing. No one has, you know, that I know of, has sort of come up with a really robust approach that they're making money yet, and it, you know, I think it'll remain to be seen. It probably depends a little bit on regulation in different countries, who can do it and how the data can be shared, in addition to who can offer the credit, but how the data can be shared and that sort of thing. And it'll, you know, I think it'll also come down to just sort of, you know, who ends up having the power and,
The one other piece that I wanted to just mention about your question was, When you look at access, it's an issue for men and women, and literacy is an issue, and energy is an issue. They're all issues for both men and women, and even more so for women, because of all the barriers that you've talked about. But you know, to speak to Jake's point, it's much easier to get a mobile phone than it is to get a bank account, especially in the rural areas that you're talking about. And if you know, it moves forward where you are able to get credit through a phone, either through a bank or through an MNO, it is going to be much easier to do that with a mobile phone than going to a bank or going to a microfinance, formal financial institution. And so, absolutely, it's not a panacea, and there are lots of issues. And one thing that I'd like to highlight here, too, is our M Women Alliance. And you know, Chris Burns from USAID is also working with GSMA and others on that, and so that's some of the questions they're asking and some of the research they're doing as well.
Mm-hmm. So there are a few interesting questions online, and I think I would like to ask one from Jatidne Handu. He's mentioning here that India is a huge market with 410 million unbanked, but mobile banking hasn't really taken off as in Africa, and despite of the deep mobile penetration. What are your thoughts on that, and why didn't it reach scale? And then another question also similar to that from Sarah Sturville. She would like to for you to speak a little bit more about the reliability of cell phones in Africa, and she says here that because services are better in Kenya, does it affect the speed of adaptive technology between other households in comparison to Kenya?
Well, so in answer to the question on India, I mean, the situation in India is fairly complex, but I think a lot of it comes down to regulation. And, you know, I would go back to what I said about mobile players should be allowed to contest the payment space. They're not allowed to do that in India, and you just haven't seen much progress because the regulations in India require banks to be sort of the leading player in any mobile payment scheme. And, you know, you just haven't seen much progress in rolling out the systems there. So I think until, you know, I don't know. I mean, I can't predict what's going to happen in India, but I think that would probably help things move faster if they were more liberal in terms of how mobile operators could get into the market. Sorry, could you repeat the other question?
The other question is about how fast the services are adopted in other households in Africa in comparison to Kenya. And the question is, because in Kenya the services are more reliable, maybe the technology is adopted and used faster than in other places.
Well, I'm not sure how reliable. The service in Kenya is quite good, especially at the agent level. So what Safaricom was brilliant at doing was getting these agents all over the country and getting them to hold liquidity and electronic value such that they were always, well, not always, but, you know, most of the time they were ready to do a transaction when a customer came through the door. What you've seen in other places is that that's not the case. You know, you look at agent networks in some of the other countries, and they just haven't performed very well. So I think that, to me, is probably the much bigger factor than, say, the reliability of the system. The M-Pesa system actually has, you know, a lot of downtime. And that sort of thing. I don't know how it compares to other systems, but you know, there is that sort of issue.
But I think, just to your point, trust in the system is the biggest piece. So, and that's like agent network, that's how strong the actual operation is, and that's sort of reputation as well. And, you know, they say that's one of the factors in Kenya and in other countries when mobile money is popular, they have more trust in that system, in the mobile network operator system, than they do in banks. And so, you know, it consistently comes up as a theme in terms of when an electronic payment system is successful, there has to be trust in that system. Absolutely reliability of the actual network is important, but even more so, just do you trust them as a company to hold your money?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Thank you. Are there questions in the room?
So you talked about digital payments, and you've mostly focused on mobile transfers.
Right.
Can you go into some of the other models that are digitally based? Like, for example, would a banking correspondent model in India be one of these models that you're talking about? And can you give us some more examples?
Yeah, so there's not I would say that a bank in general is digitally based. I mean, if I, you know, once I put money into the bank, it essentially becomes digital in the sense that they're not holding my cash in a little box with my name on it, right? They just have a record that I have money, and if I want to transfer it to someone else, it switches in digital form, or in some banks in paper form, you know, but ledger form from one person to the next. So I think, you know, conceptually banks are digital as well. They're often a little bit more of an island than a mobile money system. Mobile monies are set up inherently to be payment services, right? To move money between people and eventually to pay utility bills and all this kind of thing. Banks don't give you, in particular, the ability to move money between people as much because often they're geographically sort of, you know, contained, or, you know, whoever your cousin or whoever is not part of the same bank that you are, and therefore it's much more costly to send them money. So there's fundamental differences, but in theory I think they're digital as well. Other examples, I'm struggling a bit in terms of things that are comparable to mobile money. I mean, there's plenty that are sort of theoretically comparable in the same way that banks are, but there's not a lot that are that are coming to mind for me right now that are sort of very similar to mobile, but different. I mean, credit card systems and the sort of whole debit card, credit card sort of based system in developed economies achieve some of the same things, but it's quite a bit different structure. So.
Yeah, I would add to that, and I'd agree. You know, I think agent banking, credit card systems, even in Latin America, are many times digital, and banking systems, agent banking, and then there are new systems coming out, and you know, there is also some due diligence I think that needs to be done on sort of cloud-based systems. There are some, Jake just mentioned some things that are coming up on trying to have a mobile money account when you don't have a mobile phone. So it's like multiple mobile money accounts on one SIM card, and things like that. So there are, and that's why, you know, I think one of our other series that QED holds on behalf of USAID is the Emerging Payment System Seminars. And there's just new stuff coming up every few months. So
receiving money electronically doesn't mean that you will... Oh, sorry, Priya Jaisinghani, USAID. So if you receive money electronically, it doesn't necessarily mean that you'll keep money electronically. Mm-hmm. So can you talk to what you found in terms of ways to motivate people to keep the money in the system, what's worked, what hasn't?
I'd like to be able to, but I'm not sure that we have any truly sort of, you know, knock the ball out of the park examples. I mean, you do see in Kenya sort of more of that behavior, but it's definitely not pervasive at this point. And a lot of, you know, the quote-unquote loop you know, value gets broken and turned into cash
pretty
most
quickly.
Of the time.
Yeah.
We did some financial diaries. Seemingly, but I think you know, it's not just merchants, but like you can't necessarily pay your school fees, or you know, there's just a lot of things you want to do with money that you can't. They're not all on the system at the moment. So.
I'd say there's two pieces. One is trust. Again, it goes back to trust. So I think as you, you know, we were just speaking to Michael Joseph today, who was sort of one of the, founding fathers of M-Pesa, or the founding father of M-Pesa, and with the mobile network operator Safaricom, and he said sort of in the beginning it was cash in and cash out for most of the time, and then as time went on and people began to trust the system, they began to keep more money into the system because they knew that it would be there, that they could get it back out when they needed it. And then as time went on, there are a few vendors, there are a few places where you can pay for things like school fees or a cup of coffee or things like that, and so if you can pay for things with it, then you don't need to cash out because you can just pay with it. But if that doesn't exist, then what's the point? You would just want to cash out, I think, would be.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we actually talked to a number of people about this particular issue and, like, what makes people keep money on the system. And we talked to, like, Elon Musk, who I think was the founder of PayPal, right? And his view was that it's not just trust. I mean, it's obviously, you know, clearly you have to trust the system, but it's also, like, what can you do with it? So.
Right.
I'll leave more money in a situation where I can then use it from there to do other things, whereas, I mean, that's what the beauty of cash is. I can pretty much use it for everything, and that's why I might pull money out into cash because, you know, there's so many use cases for it. So, you know.
But are you seeing kind of more explicit incentives like matching savings funds or providing discounts if you use mobile money? That's one of the things we're pioneering in Afghanistan is offering a 5% discount of goods purchased with mobile money. But I don't know if there's other examples that's really trying to press that point.
Yeah, I mean, there's two sorts of behaviors, right? One is value storage for the longer run, which is really savings, and then one is more of a transactional motivation for holding value in a form that you're going to then use. You know, you're really thinking about how you're going to use it as opposed to building up a balance or something. I think with the savings, we actually haven't seen that much impact in some cases from incentives. I mean, people don't care that much about interest rates. they say that they do, but their behavior doesn't really show that they do that much. And I don't think that's because they're irrational. It's just because if you're putting the money there, it's probably that your other alternatives are very poor. And so what you're thinking about are other things other than interest rates and that sort of thing. So, but there hasn't been a lot of study on that stuff. So.
Thank you. There's a similar question online from Mike, Princeton University. He's asking about how long people are keeping their floats in a digital transfer system. Potentially, are they using this as a saving mechanism? So I think that you've answered that question. If you have any follow-up specifically. And then there's an interesting question from Anne Wilson.
Yeah, I was looking at that too, yeah.
Yeah. Anne said that in the beginning, Jake indicated that digital-based models solve cost barriers, but in case of banks that Anne is working with, she found out that banks cover the inherent costs of cash transactions, but clients had to cover the new fee-based cost of digital or mobile transaction. So how do you encourage clients then to move from cash to digital transactions if they have to cover those extra costs? Yeah. So even though that the costs are reduced to the banks, they're not reduced to the clients then.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I mean, just in terms of the first question you asked about people leaving money on sort of mobile money systems, you know, I think what Michael Joseph said has showed up in other places as well. So people do tend to leave balances on longer and build bigger balances over time. In terms of so that's a very interesting question. Banks tend to subsidize the transaction costs because what they want people to do is bring money in and leave it in their bank, so they don't want to charge you for putting money in. Often they have a fee on withdrawal or something like that. Whereas in the mobile case, you know, you're paying pretty much every single transaction, or you know, if it's a system like M-Pesa anyway. I think, you know, I mean, first I would just say that from the perspective of the providers, what that results in is them screening out people from using bank-based systems who are going to do a lot of transactions, and so. You might say, well, people are getting a raw deal, but actually they're probably just getting any kind of deal if they're using mobile.
That's right.
Versus maybe they're not getting a deal in the bank-based system. They're paying for that service another way, often through a monthly fee or something like that. So, I mean, that's one element of it, I think.
Just to add to that, so the question really is sort of, you know, it's a really interesting question, and what's important to understand is so there's a cost of cash and there's a cost of banking to poor people, and or to everyone really in any country. And when we were in Kenya, we were talking to one of the banks about how much it costs them to just do a transfer of a member within their bank. So if I wanted to transfer $5 to Jake within the bank itself, they still would charge me money, even though it's just really, as you say, moving two or three clicks within the system. And so if it's within two banks, it's an even more amount. I think they actually, it's like 100 times more of how it would normally would be just within the bank. And so then if you compare the cost of how much it costs for per person to have a bank account and to travel to a formal financial institution, so not just banks but MFIs as well, and sort of engage in that kind of relationship versus the cost that it takes them to usually engage in some sort of electronic transfer, mobile money, or others as we talked about, then the cost makes sense. A lot of the time when you do actually do the math and you do the cost breakdown. So there's like the cost of cash and there's the cost of engaging in formal financial transactions, and they're still high, especially for poor people, especially if you add in travel time and travel cost. And so it's still quite often, not always, makes sense to be transacting in electronic payments for poor people because it's still less costly for them.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, sorry, you gave me time to think, so now I have a rest. In terms of, you know, how do we migrate people on if they're paying fees every time they use it, I think that's a very interesting question as well. I mean, it goes back to, I think, finding the places in their financial life where they're willing to pay for it, right? I mean, the long-distance domestic remittances and that sort of thing are, you know, kind of the initial use case for that reason. It is something people are willing to pay for. They have high need and very bad alternatives. But once you get enough people onto the system, you can start to develop other use cases that maybe people wouldn't be willing to pay for as much, like, say, putting money into your savings account. And providers, I think, are already starting to think about how do you do pricing schemes so that you get people to pay the amount the most for long-distance transfers, but then, you know, differentially price for these other use cases where, you know, you might as once you have them on the system, you might as well pick up the business through much smaller transaction costs. So you could, I think we'll start to see, you know, once people migrate onto the system, you'll see, you know, other services being offered and then sort of more complex pricing schemes that facilitate people using those things where they might not be willing to pay the full, you know, 30 shilling transaction cost of a long distance payment. So I think the systems will evolve in that direction, but it takes time.
Maybe since we only have 10 minutes left, we should take two questions at
so
a time.
This gentleman in the front has had his hand raised for a little while.
Sorry.
Yes.
Mine was more of a comment on that one, so maybe if I could go first. My name is Michelle Anish. I'm from CDAP, Business Model and Technology team. Just in terms of the costs, it's, I think the key point which was made there is the difference between explicit and implicit costs, and how do we make people aware of those you know, implicit costs of cash. And I think we see the same problem at the merchant level. So you've got this merchant discount, and you've you know, which is kind of a clear, it's 3% or whatever it is, so it makes it really, you know, in your face. And then the cost caches of security, of transport, of time, all of those are kind of underneath, which makes it more difficult to sort of compare them directly. That's
great, yeah. And always good to hear from CGAP, so they say what I'm saying is correct.
I was wondering if you could connect for me two of the big points which came out of your presentation. One of them is that remittances is a very big market.
Right.
You then had a slide which said, you know, the magic can be if you bring down the $4 per transaction of a cash society down all the way down to something which seemed to be at 0.5 cents or 5 cents
right.
in cashless. Could you take the example which you started with of the sort of emergency going from the city to the person in the rural need? Is there anything which is a total sort of cashless loop? Because presumably as the money gets transmitted through mobile down to the rural person, she still can't pay directly by mobile to the doctor or whatever. Or is there a total system which is already working at that 5 cent level in remittances?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. So the 5 cent level is really the you know, supposed to be sort of representative of the cost of the actual electronic transaction. So that's kind of what the costs are now. Of course, people are paying quite a bit more potentially, but in terms of seeing that full loop, it's you see pieces of it. You see, in some sense, you see all the pieces of it, but not connected, right? So in Kenya or Tanzania, where sort of the more built out systems are, you know, you see people paying schools fees with mobile money. You see those school, you know, you see schools paying their employees. You see, you know, people who have jobs sending money to people who to pay school fees. So that whole loop is there, but I think it's very rare that you actually get someone, you know, the money actually goes through a full loop like that, because lots of schools don't pay their, you know, lots of schools don't pay their employees. They pay them in cash. Lots of schools don't accept maybe money from mobile. So do you see what I mean? Like, you see the pieces in place, but it's not pervasive enough for it to truly be kind of universal.
So the corollary question is, who is ever going to put this together? Sort of between the bank and mobile and maybe even the national
yeah.
policy before all of those pieces will get connected together?
Yeah. Well, I think the thing that, yeah, so that's a good point too. It's definitely not going to be us. it's got to be, you know, the private market and the public sector within the countries. I mean, I think that's who's got to do it. But what gives us hope, I think, is that if you can demonstrate the model enough times and sort of show it working, I think the incentive is there for all the stakeholders to do the right thing. So schools, you know, there's a blog post that Ignacio Mas did on this school called Bridge Academies. They have this amazing, I mean, they're kind of an interesting business model in and of themselves, but their, you know, their idea is to do really low-cost schooling, and then scale it up all over Africa. So they've invested a huge amount of time and thought in just thinking about their systems and processes so that they can manage a school with as little, you know, input as possible. And one of the things they've done is intensively use mobile money because it allows them to track records and you know, avoid getting robbed and all this kind of stuff. So they're kind of doing the full thing. But you know, you don't see that elsewhere, I guess. So, yeah.
Do we have any more questions from the audience?
Thanks. I am Stiff Entemes here from the Private Sector Department at Oxfam America. Thanks for a great presentation. You indicated a bit earlier in your presentation, I think, that there's the integration of services can make a difference in terms of adoption, that having different entry points or different use cases, I think was the word you used. I'd love to hear you elaborate a bit on that, because we're actually working on an integrated financial services project, insurance, credits, savings, agricultural extension services, and so forth. But naturally, things start to get complicated when you put them together. So could you talk a little bit about what difference it makes to combine services together, some of the challenges and opportunities there?
Yeah. So I would say that it's – so there's sort of two elements in my mind, right? I think people – when we talked about earlier, right, when people have – going to keep their money on a system, they want to be able to do things with it, and that seems pretty obvious, I think, right? Although, you know, we don't have a lot of sort of hard evidence of that's the case, but just talking to practitioners in developed economies and other places, that kind of what we pretty sure is true. The issue, the challenge, though, comes when you try to market and sell product where you really need to make it simple for people to understand why they should bother to use it and why they should, you know, spend their time bringing their ID to the agent and signing up for it and then paying for it, right? The marketing and the sales element of all this, you know, often is ignored because it's not kind of as interesting theoretically as closing the cash loop and, you know, delivering payment, other services over the platform and that sort of thing. But that's actually one of the hugest challenges in any of these, I think in marketing financial services to the poor in general is really convincing them through simple messages, you know, why they should use something. So when you start adding lots of different functionality and features to something, you have to then think pretty carefully about how you sell it, because it can be it can sort of blur the message and get complex. And it's also something where, you know, the more messages, gets harder for the agents themselves, or the frontline workers to remember, the whole sales pitch or whatever it is. So I think you need to just sort of figure that element of it out as a big part of it. But I mean, obviously, in the long run, you want as much functionality as possible going over the system, because once you have people's money in sort of digital form and other players starting to connect to the system, you know, there's a huge sort of synergy that comes about.
Can I just ask a clarifying question? Were you, in addition to asking about sort of individuals, were you also asking about sort of organizations, sort of going back to sort of the SME value chain slide that he was talking about, or... What specifically were you...
I was referring to individual consumers.
Okay.
This is a great answer. Thanks.
Nandan, if you have any questions you'd like to take from the online audience, maybe one more from the room.
Why don't you take the one from the room, and I'll choose
okay. One
from here.
I'm Rick Doran with the GBI initiative. And one question I have that's kind of similar is... kind of deals with the upfront costs and kind of continued costs of setting up a mobile money system through the operator. You talked a little bit about, you know, showing a model to prove that this will be profitable in the future. As kind of in part of your model or in any other models, kind of the technology aspect of setting this up, and then also, again, kind of the agent aspect, setting up and then continued cost with it. Has that been included in any kind of model?
Well, first, models don't prove anything. They're good sales tools. That model might have had McKinsey's hands on it at some point, so I'm not sure that it proves things. So your question is, have we sort of done more of in-depth modeling of sort of long-run profitability based on the initial investment and that sort of thing? We've tried to, but I mean, I think the, you know, modeling helps you sort of see what factors are important, but I don't trust modeling personally to do anything that's like an exact measure of, you know, future profitability and that sort of thing, because you often underestimate the brilliance of whoever ends up being the entrepreneur and implementing it to cut costs and raise revenue and that sort of thing. Or maybe you overestimate their ability to overcome fundamental challenges. I get queasy a little bit around modeling that's complex. I think it's helpful to show what factors are important because you can move things and see. But yeah, but I mean, we have, you know, we have tried to, and we, well, I think we've with so in terms of just sort of abstract modeling, that would be my thought. We've definitely looked pretty closely at some of the, you know, we're making investments with some of the mobile money players around the world who seem poised to kind of go to scale and achieve success. And in those cases, we're looking directly at their data and sort of trying to understand their business models and their, you know, potential for long-run profitability. And so there we have actual, you know, data from real suppliers and that sort of thing. And you know, they do become profitable in the end. I can't tell you much more than that on who, but, you know, I think a lot of them launched these services as a way to retain customers. They didn't actually expect to make money. Like at Safaricom, Michael Joseph will tell you, you know, they didn't expect to make money on it. They just wanted to kind of hold down customer churn and keep up customer loyalty. But in the end, they are making money on it now. So, you know, I think they do. Most of them now are sort of hoping to make money, but not necessarily launching them with that expectation from the beginning.
Okay. Just on that question, there's two. I mean, and you probably already know this, but because there's a bunch of studies, especially out of GSMA, about it. But you know, there's sort of the fixed costs and the variable costs. So the fixed cost is really the technology and buying the platform and integrating it into the system as a value-added service. And the second is really the agent network. And everyone has talked about sort of how the agent network and then also the marketing and targeting pieces that Jake has talked about that are really key. I mean, they're not something you can just sort of toss away or just, you know, replicate another model. So those three pieces are really the largest costs. And the costs vary depending on what the deployment looks like. And the return on investment has varied depending on the deployment. Yeah. And so I don't know if anyone has sort of a magic number, magic equation yet on what that looks like. I'll read one question that I think is great from Gen.
Sorry, can I do a shameless plug
yes,
for my
do
own
it.
Work?
Go ahead.
Just on that, you mentioned that's
as long as it's shameless.
The cost of and it's just completely shameless. The cost of sales and marketing. Graham Wright from Microsave and myself and Maria Amazon from the foundation were writing this paper on that topic. Actually, it's going to come out hopefully in the next
What's
month.
What's the
or
topic
two.
Again?
On shameless plug. we just looked at some of the players who are actually trying to go completely virtual in terms of not setting up their own retail infrastructure, but really just using mobile money or some sort of mobile-based system to do, you know, to offer products over that. And there, their biggest challenge tends to be marketing and reaching the poor people who are potentially unbanked or not very financially literate at the moment, with a clear message that explains to them why they should be trying or using or paying for this particular product. So I think that part just gets overlooked a lot, and it's just, I don't know, I just wanted to kind of plug it again because it is just a huge challenge for anybody who's trying to do financial services.
So for those of you that are looking to have careers in this field, marketing is something you can try to do?
Right.
And I know there's a question back there, but Genzo Yamamoto has asked a very good question, so let me read it out loud if you don't mind. Letting the market lead or letting telcos or banks compete makes sense, but this may take years for market configurations to stabilize. Meanwhile, microfinance institutions seeking to work with these mobile network operators may find it too expensive, especially if they're only trying to work with one organization. And it may also be risky if you're just betting everything on one organization. Would this delay outreach to the poor? And are there any ways to facilitate stability in the market faster?
So
it's a good question,
right? Very good observation, and I don't think that there's a good answer. I mean, I think he's absolutely right. In most countries, in a lot of countries, it's not going to be a short-term solution. In most countries, frankly, it's not going to be a short-term solution, at least not, you know, not this year or next year. And even after that, when, you know, when and if mobile money deployments are a little bit more robust in different countries, in, you know, in more countries than they are now, the price is going to stay high for a while. Because, like I said, I think there's a natural migration from high price and sort of single use case to, you know, sort of differentiated prices and multiple use cases, hopefully. But, yeah, we're don't hold your breath. We're maybe just hold it for a little while.
I mean, the other, I mean, the one of the answers that many people will also give, in addition to what Jake said, is like sort of the case for interoperability or the capacity for interoperability. And so, if mobile network operators have interoperable systems or APIs, or sort of basically the data systems have backends that people can plug into with their financial systems, like microfinance institutions, then that allows them to work more easily with multiple mobile network operators. In Kenya, the Safaricom API is pretty difficult, if not impossible, to plug into easily, anyways, while the others are trying to make theirs a little bit more easy to plug into. And so microfinance institutions in Kenya that are trying to be able to support multiple electronic payment systems, you know, have it easier on some of the other ones, but they're not as popular. So there's an issue there. And so it really depends on as these systems grow, you know, whoever's helping them grow, you know, may try to at least develop the capacity for interoperability within these systems. As things move forward, it makes things go easier, especially in trying to reach the poor. Dasha?
So I think that we should wrap up. It's 5:30, but please do stay and ask your questions. I hope that Jake and Anjani will be able to respond. The questions that we had from webinar that we didn't get to ask, I will also post as comments, so you can refer to them later. And I would also like to mention that the next seminar will be here on May 16th, and we will discuss commitment savings. So it will be a presentation with John Robinson, who will be joining remotely from University of Southern California. He will discuss his work in Kenya. And we will have a presenter from University of Maryland discussing her work in Malawi in commitment savings, and also we will have a presenter from IPA. It will most likely be Ratan, Ishvahara Ratan. So please stay tuned and participate, and we also have two seminars this week. If you're interested to learn about value chain in Indonesia, please come here on Thursday morning, and on Friday morning we have a seminar to discuss how mobile money can improve access to finance to people with disabilities. So please participate, and thank you so much for your time today and for the interesting presentation. Thank you.